So it is 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and as always, it is time now for office hour. Before we begin, I want to remind you that the views that are presented on the show may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So, as we always do at 5 o'clock, Professor Jay here, we go and we knock on the door of the all these beautiful buildings here on campus to try to find out what's going on in this campus. Now, here we are the first week in the quarter. People are back hiding in their buildings, doing all kinds of research, talking about all kinds of things. And here at Public Affairs, we want to share it with the listeners and the general public. And I'm very pleased today. Can you hear that knock? Here I go. I'm knocking on the door of the History Department, which I, many friends, I'm a big fan of the History Department here. And I'm very excited to have Katie Harris from the History Department here today. So welcome, Katie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And what we're going to talk about today is some pretty wild stuff. People breaking into cemeteries and churches, stealing bones. And questions which I think are very, very alive today, which is fake news, evidence, how do we know what's real, how do we know what really happened, how do we make decisions, who owns the authority, what kinds of evidence do we bring forward. So we're going to look at not the 2019 version of this all. We're going to go back into the 17th century and find out what was true in the 17th, what was truth and evidence in the 17th century. But as always, before we begin talking about these fascinating topics, we always want to find out how Katie Harris became a specialist in bone theft in the 17th century in Europe. I mean, it doesn't seem like, again, something that you just seems like an automatic topic you want to spend your life investigating. So tell us, how did you come to be a historian, and how in particular a historian of these kinds of topics?
Well, the sad truth is I always wanted to be a historian.
Well, what's sad about that? You always wanted to be a historian?
Yeah.
That's good. That's a good story.
Well, you know, it's a little embarrassing to admit that my sister and I used to play professor as small children. Yeah. I don't know what we were doing, grading papers or something. That's kind of silly, but that's the facts. And so I have pursued this, not single-mindedly, but certainly it's been what I've always wanted to do. As a history major as an undergraduate, mm-hmm. and then on into graduate school, has always been my dream, and I've managed to do it.
So when you were a history major as an undergraduate, did you already know what kind of history you wanted to study? I'm always curious when people kind of fall into their life topics. Does it happen freshman week? That seems maybe even in high school, or did it take a while for you to figure out? You always knew you wanted to be a historian, but
the one thing I knew is I didn't want to do U.S. history.
Didn't want to do U.S. history. Okay, now not to say anything that will offend any of our U.S. historian colleagues. Why not? Why? What was it about European history that was so appealing to you?
I just found it more engaging, and it had always fascinated me. And then when I went off to college, I looked at all the offerings of the history department at the school where I was going, and got really excited to take Latin American history, because I was very embarrassed to realize in thinking about it that I knew precisely nothing about Latin American history. So I took a lot of Latin American history and was very excited about that. And then things changed when I did what many people do. I did a study abroad program.
Yes, we've heard that many times.
No doubt.
So you went off, and I take it you didn't go to Latin America.
No, I didn't. I went to Spain. I went to Cordoba in southern Spain. And Cordoba is an exceptionally beautiful place. It is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It is had been the seat of the Caliphate of Cordoba, one of the great seats of power when much of the Iberian Peninsula was part of the larger Islamic world. And it is a place of extraordinary beauty. And I was captured.
And that was it.
That was it.
And that's it. And the rest, and here you are today, especially working on 17th century Spain and Europe in general. So, I mean, I think that's really a very interesting story about if you're going to spend your life studying something, you might as well study a place that's really beautiful.
Well, this is something my dissertation director told me. He said, oh, you know, pick a topic where you're going to go and study in a nice place, a pretty place. Don't pick some yucky industrial town, unless that's what you want to do. Uh-huh. Pick somewhere nice.
Unless you find beauty in that.
Unless you find beauty in that, which I didn't. So I found it was good advice.
Uh-huh. Well, we traveled in Spain 2 summers ago, and it was a wonderful country to visit with many wonderful kinds of foods and beautiful things to see. So I can certainly understand. I just got there too late in my life to have that become. So now what we're going to talk about is to start off this conversation about truth and evidence in the 17th century, and particularly around issues of religion and religious relics. You start off this forthcoming book that you're working on with this particular incident, which is quite a fascinating incident that you're talking about in 1655, just to get the listeners oriented here. This is in Spain?
It takes the initial event takes place in Rome.
Right.
And what happens is in March 1655, two friars, members of a religious order known as the Order of the Most Holy Trinity Redemption of Captives. It's a long name.
We usually
just call them the Trinitarian Order. Basically, they tiptoed out of their monastery in the middle of the night, breaking curfew, and traversed the city, going about 3 kilometers to a part of Rome that was in a semi-abandoned neighborhood. And they essentially broke into a small church. The church had once belonged to their order, but had been lost by the order some centuries before. And they broke into this church. And then once inside, they took a crowbar and opened up a tomb in the church, wherein were held the bones of the founder of their order, whose name is St. John of Mata, or San Juan de Mata. And they hadn't thought too far ahead. They thought to bring a crowbar, but they hadn't brought a bag. And so they had to hastily improvise a bag out of what amounts to one of their underwear. This is not orthodox behavior. And they took those bones and then tiptoed right back out of the church and crossed the city again and went back to their monastery and hid them in the monastery.
Uh-huh. Now, and the connection to Spain is that this was a Spanish order?
It's actually a French order, but in this period, it was the Spanish were particularly dominant.
So it was dominated by the Spanish. So we have this story then. So it's possible that they weren't sure they were going to take the bones, do you think? Or, I mean, they did take a crowbar along, so
they were planning this for sure. They brought a crowbar and
they were planning
a candle
on taking the bones.
And things for striking a light. They just, for some reason, didn't bring a bag. I don't think they thought that far.
So they go and they steal bones. And it turns out that stealing bones, they're not alone in stealing bones.
No, there is a long tradition of this, stealing specifically, not just any bones, holy bones.
Right.
There's a long tradition of this. But the thing is that by the middle of the 17th century, this wasn't particularly common, nor was it particularly condoned. It was truly against the law, church law.
Mm-hmm. So they were willing to do something like we think of today, a breaking a law because of a higher law. So they actually were outlaws, and it was possible they would have been prosecuted for the bones, though these guys were never prosecuted for taking the bones.
In actual fact, they were prosecuted.
Oh, they were.
In absentia. They had already fled Rome and were long gone.
So that's why they were prosecuted, because they'd already made it up.
Yeah, but they were in fact prosecuted and were condemned. The sentence had actually been carried out, they would have been condemned to rowing in the galleys in the Mediterranean.
So probably a kind of a death sentence, because those jobs were pretty tough jobs.
Being chained to the bench so that you're rowing endlessly. That's not a great way.
Right.
To...
So what drove these guys to do something so risky to take these, steal these bones?
Well, it's a kind of crime called furta sacra, or holy theft. So it's a pious crime, a crime driven by devotion, by piety. And I think this is one of those places where I'm willing to take their testimony at face value. They say that they were driven by devotion and by a desire to have the bones of their founder properly venerated. That John of Matha was considered by the order to be a saint, and that his bones were lying in this little church, basically abandoned, nobody venerating them properly, was a real, it was an embarrassment.
And it was another kind of a crime.
Exactly.
And so when they wanted to venerate these bones, and this is a long tradition of people collecting and gathering and taking care of bones of saints. That's something that goes back for generations, decades, centuries before this. For them, what would it mean to venerate? For one thing, it would mean to bring it home. A veneration would have to be in a special place. Were there other things they did when they venerated bones?
Well, veneration, I mean, these are not merely bones. These are what we call relics, right? So they are the bodies of saints or people considered to be saints. Or in other cases, they might be objects that had been in intimate contact with somebody considered to be a saint. So like clothing or even a hairbrush, things like that. Mm-hmm. That veneration should take place in a church, or in potentially maybe a private chapel, but in a specially designated place. And veneration means lighting candles,
saying prayers to
ask for the intercession of the saint on behalf of the person praying. So this is what veneration would mean.
And you absolutely had to get those bones, even if it meant breaking the law. I'm curious, if they'd asked for them, they wouldn't have been able to get them any other way?
They were in the middle of a long decades long lawsuit with the group that controlled that church by that point, which was actually the canons of the chapter of the Vatican, some of the most powerful people in the Catholic world. So, and the canons of the Vatican were not inclined to do anything for the Trinitarian order. So.
They weren't going to let them come and collect the bones of their saint.
Mm-mm.
They were just sitting on them. So here we see, in many ways, it's even more modern than I thought, because you see this litigation going on, this long-term litigation trying to get the bones, and then somebody just getting completely frustrated with the fact they're never going to be able to get their bones through legal means, so they go to illegal means as well. So now we have this story set up, and we see that one of the things that this opens up for us is, how do you know that these are real relics? How do you know that these are real saints' bones? And how do you know, because I know we know from the famous stories like Mark Twain making fun of this, we know that there are these hundreds of bones and hundreds of pieces of wood that are said to be from the original cross. And I was quite struck by the way in which you point out that this was a major issue in the early modern European culture as well. The people wanted to have a sense that these were not fake saint bones.
The critique of relics is a long-standing one. I mean, it goes back to the earliest periods of Christianity, and there's a great deal of concern about, are they real? Are they fake? How can we know? Who can we trust? But I would suggest that it becomes particularly acute in the 16th and 17th centuries as relics and the veneration of relics and the veneration of saints comes under extra criticism or extra scrutiny in the light of the Protestant Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
That Protestants, take it right back to Luther and everybody who follows him, have nothing to do with this. They see this as not grounded in Scripture. They see it as a human invention, essentially. And so this helps deepen a larger set of problems, a larger set of concerns. How do we know? We've always said these are real. How do we know they're real? What do we do? What amounts to evidence for these things?
So the attack on the saints' relics by the Protestants, and you also mentioned by some Catholics as well, raises a whole new concern. There you are in 1655. How do you know whether these bones are the real saints' bones or not? Which is a very good question.
I mean, and it's a question that's it becomes the case for all saints' relics in this period, but the case of these now stolen bones are particularly acute, right? When these guys sneak into this church, they steal these bones, it is a wholly illegal act, and there were no witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody there to document it. Nobody there to create the sort of legal documentation that would have been necessary to track them. They don't have a clear provenance anymore. Mm-hmm. So now they have they've created this problem.
But they've exacerbated the proving of the role of their saint because they've rattling around with these bones in different places.
Exactly.
And now nobody knows.
Exactly.
So we read these articles in the paper today every so often. We'll see something about evidence to prove that someone should become a saint. So It's clearly something that's going on. But what you're saying is that there's a kind of a shift in this time period whereby the question of there's a formal process that you go through to be canonized as a saint, and that now there's a kind of extra weight that comes through and society wants to know for sure. We're going to canonize this person. How do we know that this is a real saint?
Right. And the canonization question is one that is pertinent. So say you have somebody who's freshly dead, right? A freshly dead person who is said to be holy.
Right.
That's one problem.
Right.
But what do we do with St. John of Matha, who was dead in 1213? He's long dead.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know? So there are multiple different kinds of questions here. The freshly dead, in some way, very easy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those saints or would-be saints, those are somewhat more clear.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you mean about is easy? I think actually it's probably worthwhile for us to try to lay out in a little bit more detail, how do you decide that someone is a saint? This is something that many of our listeners have probably never actually had to do. There is a formal process where you have to authenticate the remains. So one thing you do is you say these really are these person's bones.
Well, if we're talking about, like, so for example, a freshly dead person, there's usually going to be no doubt about the body is that of that person, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're recently dead. The question in the case of these much longer dead people is there will be a question of are the bodily remains that are said to be of that person actually of that person? And then there's a separate inquiry, and the inquiry for both the freshly dead and the long dead is pretty much very similar.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it's a inquiry first at the more local level, and then it's elevated to the level at Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an investigation into that person, his or her life, their morals, their what's called heroic virtue, and then also a question of their intercession for the faithful before God. So miracles as well.
What have they done?
What have they done?
What have they done?
Yeah.
Okay, so you introduced the idea that there's a category called moral certainty. And that's what people were looking for in the 17th century. They were trying to feel moral certainty around relics, which meant that they wanted to feel certain morally. I mean, moral certainty is very different than I would think of sort of like legal certainty.
Well, there's, if you think, so the category moral certainty comes to be applied, but it's worth saying that the concept of moral certainty is not one that's exclusive to talking about relics or saints or anything like that. It's actually a category that we see applied in many places.
Right.
And it's a way of talking about levels of certainty that can accommodate doubt.
Right.
So what is a level of certainty in which there is no doubt? That would be mathematical certainty. 1 + 1 is always going to be 2. I am mm-hmm. It's certain at a level that can't be disputed. Moral certainty is a kind of certainty that accommodates the question, the potential for error, the potential for doubt. Anything human is necessarily going to have to be operating at that level because we are fallible creatures.
You don't know for sure. Okay, so you made a very important point, and I think we really need to stress this, and I think it's really interesting for all of us, which is that you don't have a special way of thinking about truth when it comes to saints' relics. You use the social criteria that operated in the general society. And in the general society, there was something that was considered to be really, really likely to be true, mathematical. And then there was something called moral certainty, which operated at a level where you didn't really feel you would ever know for sure. So is that sort of like what we would call the preponderance of belief?
That's pretty close to it. Yeah. I mean, the idea that there's the potential for error or potential for doubt, but it's not very likely.
So it's not very likely. So is this somewhat new? Was there something new about this mode of using the idea of moral certainty at this time period? Was the sort of the criteria of truth shifting? And you can look back as a historian and see how the idea of what is true and what is fake actually sort of unfolds in different ways?
Well, if you think about it, this is a period in which questions of what is true are actually very, very acute, because the ground on which truth is placed has been shifting a great deal. Consider the truths that have shifted in the course of the 16th and 17th century. Hmm. All of a sudden, you have this strange new continent called the Americas, right?
Got to get a new map.
Right. You got to get a new map. It's not mentioned in the Bible.
That's right.
So how are you going to deal with that? You have things like all of a sudden in the course of the 16th century, prices start rising. The great price, inflationary trend of the 16th century. All of a sudden, metals, precious metals, silver, but especially gold, that had always been thought to be fixed in their value, start fluctuating. And economics is, of course, in its infancy in this period. People are struggling to understand, well, gold is supposed to be always this valuable thing, and now it's not. Even that can't be trusted. Even there, the truth of that is in question. And again, coming back to the Protestant Reformation, who has truth with a capital T is under a great deal of question, right? Mm-hmm. There is a preacher on every street corner, and every one of them claims to have the truth. Who do you believe? It's acute.
Okay, so, and that's a good confluence of really social crises over truth. So I think that's extremely valuable for us to repeat how many different areas there were major questions. As I say, the world doesn't look the same way. The economic systems that we've relied on are not the same. The belief systems that we've relied on are being also brought under new scrutiny and new kinds of doubt in it. So what happens then, stepping back and looking at this, what happens to the truth? Does it demand a shift in the mode of argumentation? Does it demand lowering the level of expectations about what you're going to be able to say is true? Do you call upon new types of evidence to come into these discussions? What do you do when the truth is under so much attack?
Well, you certainly start questioning the truth itself is shifting, right? And truth becomes, at least for some, I mean, if you can go in very skeptical directions as well, there will be those in the 17th mm-hmm. century who will argue, well, there really isn't any truth. Uh-huh. But you'll certainly see people looking to reconsider evidence in some interesting ways.
Right.
And looking to critique evidence in new ways and to bring to bear thinking about evidence and different types of evidence, bringing those in as perhaps we can bring those in and reconsider truth on new grounds.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So we don't know what's true anymore. We can't just be sloppy with our evidence the way we used to. We have to decide what is good evidence. So, and you talk here about three types of evidence. They're pretty broad categories. They seem to me to be somewhat, I don't know how helpful they were if I was actually trying to make a decision. You talk about there's something called human evidence. Mm-hmm. There's something called divine evidence. And there's something called mixed human divine evidence.
These are not the best categories, are they?
if you're raising, how do you up the ante in human evidence? How do you try to make new demands for human evidence? Do you look for a new type of documentation, for example?
Well, you might look to reconsider the quality of your documentation.
Uh-huh.
You might start to think about, well, you know, what is this document? When does it come from? How do I know when it is made? Do I know that it's the real thing? How do I know it's not a forgery? This is exactly the same period in which we see historians, literary critics, turning their attentions, their critical faculties onto documents of all kinds and bringing that to bear on them and questioning them. So, I'm mostly working on the 17th century, but we can dial it back a bit and talk about humanist criticisms of documentation. Think of Lorenzo Valla and the Donation of Constantine, right? The classic example of a humanist scholar basically debunking a document that had long been considered to be authentic And doing it through careful, critical reading. Mm-hmm. By the time we get to the 17th century, that kind of reading is being brought in, not just in secular history, but it's also being brought to bear on ecclesiastical history, sacred history, all mm-hmm. of the things that one might consider to be outside the bounds of criticism in that way, absolutely brought under into critical.
Everything has to be looked at. When we have such a big problem about knowing what's true, we have to subject all evidence to more extensive investigation.
And that includes the saints, that includes their bodies, that includes all of it. So hagiography, the writing of the lives of saints, which is the most popular type of publication in the 17th century. You go and look at what people are reading. They're reading lives of saints. These are being transformed in this period as the people writing them are being ever more critical about the kinds of documentation that they draw on and what kinds of legends are they willing to tell or which ones do they think are just going too far to be believed.
Would you go so far as to say the stories had been read very naively prior to that, that nobody really asked much about, they just read the stories of the saints without having too many they kind of expected them to be full of miracles. They were full of miracles. They weren't particularly interested in asking, is this likely to really have happened? Or do you not really know what prior readings were like?
We don't know a lot about what prior readings were like, and sometimes because it's often very hard to capture a reader response.
Right.
Reader responses are for the most part evanescent and not recorded for us. I would not go so far to say that, you know, everybody was super naive prior to having the veil fall from their eyes and they begin to be critical readers. But I do think that there is a trend towards being less willing to repeat the stories just because the stories have always been told.
And just because they're written down and handed on to you.
That's right.
Exactly. Terrific. Well, we reached the end of our first segment today with Katie Harris on the stealing and evaluation of relics of the saints in the 17th century in Europe. So we're going to take a quick break and we will be back for second part. And we will talk about what happens when these new demands are made. Interestingly enough, there's a rise in forgery. The demand for new evidence means that sometimes people actually have to go out and make new evidence. So stay with us. So welcome back to segment 2 of Office Hour Today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And I'm talking with Katie Harris from the History Department. We started off with a story of breaking into a church in Rome and stealing some bones that the Vatican had. And the people who ran the order felt that those bones belonged to them. So they steal off with those bones. They get out of town quick, which is good, as we learned, because otherwise they probably would have been prosecuted and sent off to some kind of servitude. And then the question becomes, how do we evaluate, how did they evaluate then in the 17th century, whether these were real saints' bones or not? So it falls on other people to make the case. And from what I understood, this is a really great example, because the first time that they tried to certify these bones as being this guy's bones, the fact that they'd stolen them and taken them away actually raised a lot of questions, and they were not accepted as being the authentic bones of the authentic founder of the order, and they had to go back and do more and more work. And tell us a little bit about what that process then led to.
Well, in 1669, the order applies to the Congregation of Rites, which is the Vatican department, essentially in charge of saints and authentication of saints and canonizations and stuff like that, and applies to have the stolen bones authenticated as being those of John of Matha. And they put forward this case and they make all these arguments, and the ruling comes down, nope. Basically, the cardinals of the congregation said, no, you haven't proven it.
They felt that it did not meet the evidentiary requirement.
It did not meet the evidentiary requirements. And the order tries repeatedly There are multiple attempts. It's a little unclear to me quite how many there are, whether it's three or four is a little bit unclear from the documentation. It's not until 1721, so what is that, 70 years after the original theft, that they're finally successful and get the Congregation of Rites to say, yes, with this is, you have proven it enough. Yes, those bones are those of St. John of Malta.
Mm-hmm. And was the rise of forgery part of that process? Because you talk about the fact that one thing that people needed to do in these cases with the people who'd been dead for a while is they needed to find documents in order to meet the standard of evidence. So what you need to do then, oddly enough, the pressure for more evidence led to the pressure for more fake documents.
That's right. That's right. In order to make the case, the order needed to have better documentation of its own history. Now, one thing I have not been able to figure out is why the Trinitarian order seems to have spent multiple centuries not particularly interested in its own past. I don't understand that yet, and I'm trying to figure it out. But as near as I can tell, basically, in the 17th century, the order found itself having to deal with the fact that it simply didn't have
records.
Records. Yeah. It didn't have the kind of records that it needed. And one friar seems to have stepped forward and created exactly what was needed.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say created what was needed, you're basically saying he made up documents.
He did.
He did. He made up documents. So he goes there and he writes these documents. Did anybody at that time period, was anybody suspicious about his documents, or did he pretty much get a free ride because he was the one who was presenting them and we didn't have whatever kinds of resources we have today? So let's say somebody forges a bunch of documents in the late 1600s. You know, what are the chances that somebody is going to catch them?
Oh, their chances are actually pretty good.
Really?
Yes. And forgery is a growth industry in this period. So it's one of these little historical paradoxes. The more critical people are of history and of documentation, they're oftentimes the same people who are the critics are also the forgers.
So are you saying he was a critic and a forger at the same time?
Yes. He's a quite good historian, but he's quite unscrupulous.
Uh-huh. Okay. So who might have caught him out?
Well, I don't think anybody particularly caught him out, but he's not the only one. There's a second forger. The one I'm thinking of, my forger number one, his name is Friar Juan Figueras Carpi. We'll usually just call him Figueras. Mm-hmm. And he's active in the 1630s, so actually prior to the theft. So he sets the groundwork for the documentation.
For the made-up history of the order.
Correct. And near as I can tell, nobody ever called him out on it. There's one other scholar who has pointed this out, but modern scholar, right, working in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. But well, near as I can tell, aside from a few voices here and there in the 1630s, Friar Figueres got away with it.
Well, that's a pretty good run from 1630 to 1960.
Mm-hmm. He seems to have done a pretty good job.
Uh-huh. How many documents do you think like this? I don't, maybe not a number, but let's say, you know, like, was this very common at 1630, as there's more evidence needed, that people were just commonly going? Or does he stand out as sort of like a master, you know, clever guy? Or do you think a lot of people were actually forging documents, given the fact that everybody was suddenly having to have greater evidence and better looking evidence?
Well, we shouldn't paint everybody with the same brush. There are, in fact, I mean, I could name, you know, right off the top of my head, probably 10 scholars operating in the first half of the 17th century in Spain alone who are known forgers. But it's always a labor of love. It's always part of a larger project of shoring up much loved stories and much loved histories that just, it's a shame the history didn't have any documentation. Let's make some documentation. So for the most part, these people who are much invested in these kinds of stories. And Figueres is one of them. Where he differs, he gets away with it. But the person who doesn't get away with it is his successor, who also forges documents on behalf of the bones of John of Matha and for the Trinitarian order. And this is a astounding fellow whose name is Antonio Lupián Zapata. And we don't know much about him. He creates this remarkable persona that he tells us all about in the documents. He claims to be a priest. He claims to be a notary. He claims to have done a whole lot of different things. But his critics, and they're all critics that are operating right after his death, say that he's none of the things that he claims to be. He's not a nobleman. He's actually the son of a surgeon. He doesn't have any real education. And nor is he a priest, nor is he a notary. And
so he's a complete fraud.
Let's just say he's doing a lot of self-inventing.
Okay. So he invents himself, and he also invents documents.
Documents. And he's remarkable in his scope. He forges all kinds of things. He's forging genealogies. He's forging documentation of all kinds, privileges, grants. He forges a chronicle that supposedly originates from the... I'm going to say 9th century. And it's the kind of thing you create a historical source and you seed it out there, and other historians go, oh, a 9th century chronicle. That documents this
just
whole...
Just what I was looking for.
Just what I was looking for. I'm going to use this in my work. And so you find people citing him. It's insidious. It trickles into everybody's work. That's what he's most famous for. But he also is hired by the Trinitarian order, that there are records of how much they paid him. They paid him by bundles of paper. He writes this lengthy history of the Trinitarian order. And in the course of doing that, he makes up documents right and left, often drawing on the documents that his predecessor, Friar Figueras, had also invented. So he takes an invention and invents upon the invention. It's quite elaborate.
He makes fake news out of fake news.
Indeed, he really does.
Mm-hmm. So why did he get caught?
He doesn't get caught, not during his life. He appears, as far as I know, he goes to his grave.
A happy forger.
A happy forger. But shortly thereafter, people take the gloves off, and the takedowns in the literature are remarkable to read, to the point that they're in sort of these 17th century sensibilities kick in, and you have critics saying, well, my priestly modesty prevents me from saying the things, but you can go and read them in so and so and so and so and so and so, that the critiques are too harsh. And shortly after his death, he is unmasked as this incredible forger.
How do they do it? I mean, what gave him away? Was he too elaborate in what he did? He forge too much? Did he forge badly? Was he just too suspect himself? You said he was also a person who sort of reinvented himself. Is that sometimes what leads people into suspecting what he wrote?
Yes. Well, it's partly, I think, that he becomes suspect in and of himself, his persona, but also the kinds of forgeries he created are just too convenient. And
okay, listen, forgers out there, that there's a place. Don't make something that's too much what people
want.
No,
if you want to be a good forger, you have to be an extraordinary historian.
So give us an example of something that was just too convenient that he forged.
Well, the 9th century chronicle that I mentioned, right? Mm. This is just too convenient. It gives too many details of things that had been left out and unknown in Iberian history, and that they just don't match up with accepted and vetted and well-known sources. So there's a kind of overreach.
Mm-hmm.
And so good scholarship can take that kind of thing down. Careful critical reading, checking against the known sources. Does this match up? That kind of thing. And I should say, this isn't the kind of forgery, as far as I know, this is not the kind of forgery where we have somebody baking documents in an oven to make them look old and using fancy inks, although there is some suggestion he may have done that. This is a different kind of forgery. This is textual forgery in that he's writing a history and giving sources, and one source he might give in one line is a totally authentic one, and the next line is something completely made up.
So he just cites them.
He cites them, and he cites long passages from them.
And they don't exist.
And as far as we can tell, they just don't exist.
Well, I find it amazing to think, again, I'm just thinking about today, how hard it is for us to try to get some sense of what is real and what is not real in the news. How impossible it must have been in the 17th century for people to try to adjudicate those issues. You know, how do they know if someone cited some things that seemed very reasonable? It seems to me that forgery would be awfully easy. How many copies of manuscripts were there in the first place? It would be very impossible to imagine that someone had the only copy of a manuscript or traveled somewhere and found something.
Absolutely.
I mean, how do people, how would we even, in your case, you're saying, yes, but there actually were standards.
Yes, there were.
Of historical research, and people did know enough about what had happened that they would be suspicious if a text that was cited that wasn't otherwise known or something like that.
Right. So it's careful, critical reading. And in the 17th century, as today, careful, critical reading, the kinds of skills that a major in history will get you. careful, critical reading allows one to separate the wheat from the chaff. Mm-hmm. It's hard work. It's not easy. But it is the kind of thing. Yes, it can be done.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So they people then went back and got, were they able to take forged texts out of the tradition in a way? I imagine that once forgeries got edited into historical texts, it was a lot harder to get rid
it's
of them.
It's so hard to, you will find some of these forgeries, like the ones that I'm talking about, but also I'm thinking of others that were rife in the 17th century. You can find them cited well into the 20th century.
Right.
That unsuspecting scholars will cite this stuff, and in good faith, mm-hmm. and absolutely in good faith. But it's really hard. Once they're out there, it's hard to get that genie right back in the bottle.
I think that's a very important point. So I just want to reiterate it, that once fake documentation gets into the historical tradition, it's much more difficult to get rid of it,
absolutely,
to kind of prune it out. So let's go back quickly and go over the question then, which we had started on, what was evidence in the 17th century? We have something called human, divine, and mixed human divine.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that some of those would not be legal in a court of law today, right?
Well,
I don't mixed human divine, I'm not sure.
I don't think courts of law usually allow too many miracles.
Exactly. But let's just clarify for the listeners what those things are. What is human evidence? When you say human evidence, what do you mean?
Human evidence includes things like history itself, right? Mm-hmm. Historical narratives, all the documentation. These are things that human beings have created. And those are precisely the categories of evidence which moral certainty would be applied to,
mm-hmm.
right? That I can use my critical faculties to understand and critique a document, but there is always going to be a possibility that I'm wrong.
Right.
And we have to learn to live with that possibility. If you want no possibility of error, well, then history is not the place for you. You
need human stuff is not the way to go.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
But they were dependent upon human. I mean, in some ways, don't you think that would have been impossible to turn their back on human evidence?
You can't turn your back on human evidence. You can only come to terms with it and find ways to approach it and understand it. So if you can put it into, this is that kind of evidence wherein I'm only going to know 99%, there'll always be that 1% that I can't be sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's a way of accommodating yourself to it. Divine evidence? Well, divine evidence, that's the miraculous, isn't it? And that is itself also subject to a certain amount of critique or question. How do we know what's divine?
Exactly. I was hoping you would explain that to us. I mean, in the 17th century sense, how did people bring divine evidence on these cases? How do you manifest divine evidence?
Divine evidence is also itself going to be the subject of a great deal of question, right?
Right.
So if somebody says, well, I have received divine revelations, mm-hmm. it's necessarily going to be a question of, okay, well, let's investigate that, because how do we know it's God and how do we know it's not the voice of Satan?
What would be the main types of divine evidence? Dreams, maybe? Would they count as dreams?
Potentially, but those are always, again, those are questionable.
Miracles.
But miracles are also themselves not necessarily going to be subject to investigation.
Divine epiphany? Do they have many cases of that where, say, just the appearance of some kind of...
Could be, but again, every single one of these is going to be... Nobody is ever in the 17th century going to simply take for granted any kind of piece of evidence. Nothing...
Those days are over?
Those days never probably existed, but those days are definitely over. So everything is the subject to investigation and very careful investigation.
Uh-huh. And what is mixed human divine evidence?
Oh, that's a category that could include all kinds of things like, there is a tradition that is much discussed in the 17th century. I don't know that it's actually revived, but it used to be in earlier periods that alleged relics might be subjected to trial by fire. That is, you take an allegedly... a bone that is said to be the bone of Saint, the tibia of Saint so-and-so, and you put it in a fire. Does it burn? Is it burned to ash or does it come out intact, right? This is a trial by fire. So there involves both human action, but also a divine intervention.
Were people doing that?
They're more discussing it in the 17th century than they are doing it. But the fact that they're discussing it is itself pretty interesting, that they're looking for ways to establish what might be parameters or what might be techniques. And the ways that people are investigating alleged relics are very interesting in that there's a kind of pseudo-scientific quality to them.
Yes.
It's nothing. You don't imagine a bunch of people standing around in lab coats testing things in ways we might imagine. But there is a kind of trial experimentation. I've read accounts of alleged dirt that was in a tomb of a bunch of bodies said to be those of early Christian martyrs discovered in the island of Sardinia in Italy. And the experiments that are conducted on this dirt are to squeeze it and to moisten it and squeeze it and see, the dirt, the kind of the muddy water that comes running out, it's red. Aha, blood of martyrs, right? Now, that is not exactly that's not an experiment in the way we might imagine today, but it is, in fact, a kind of testing and experimentation.
So what you're saying is that partly as the bar gets raised around evidence, there's going to be a turn to try to do what we would call experimentation, even if, as you're saying, these experiments might destroy the very,
absolutely.
But the idea is that somehow you don't have someone just say that is holy.
No.
You actually do something. You actually manipulate it in some way so that you can show in some kind of parameters that can be demonstrated as evidence to everybody that there's something divine about it.
Exactly. Another example might be the kinds of autopsies that were conducted on the bodies of those who were recent dead said to be holy.
Okay, tell us about that.
It's not my area of specialty, but it's really interesting stuff. So that investigating church authorities would call in doctors, scientists, specialists in anatomy to conduct autopsies on the bodies of the recent dead.
What were they looking for?
The signs of sanctity. And signs of sanctity might be, they said that, he was pierced by the love of God and he could feel it in his heart. So let's go look at his heart.
See if it looks pierced.
Or if it looks enlarged. Things like that. So again, there's an investigative quality to it, an experimental quality to it.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like they're using the absolute most contemporary models of subjecting evidence to proof.
Absolutely, they are. The church authorities engaged in this are at the forefront of investigation and forefront of what are the newest ways of acquiring evidence.
They're the Sherlock Holmes of the 17th century,
they
right?
They absolutely
looking
are.
In that thing. So, it's fascinating examples. as you say, more observation, more experimentation, checking your documents, reading documents, including documents that may previously have not been studied as carefully because they were considered to be holy documents. Now, everything has to be subjected to investigation.
That's right. And there's an interesting kind of destabilizing effect to that as well. Right?
What do you mean?
In that when you start putting careful critique, reading these documents in new ways, in effect, you can actually destabilize them. Yes. In the same way. So one thinks too of, it's similar to, think of 19th century investigations into biblical criticism.
Yes.
Right? 19th century investigations, biblical criticism start disentangling the text of scripture. And this has an effect of kind of shaking the whole thing. It's not, wait a minute, it has a history. It has it. It's we can find different voices in it. What is this? Same thing in the 17th century.
These bones might not be real bones. So it just, having had this long discussion about evidence and forgery, it just seems to me we can't let you go before we ask you to speculate. Though I realize it is speculation. What do we learn from this as a historian bringing it to the modern world? It seems like the questions of evidence have been profoundly unsettling for people for centuries, and that there is, as you pointed out, and I thought was really a beautiful way to think about it, that when there's more pressure for evidence, there's more pressure for forgery. So that we're caught in this kind of social cycle where we want to have more evidence, but it becomes increasingly difficult to evaluate the evidence because just that pressure for truth makes for more fakeness.
Exactly. Exactly. And we are in a period in which we have whole new media, in which these pressures are coming at us and are being generated. So that adds a new kind of urgency to it, right? So fake news is nothing new, not in the slightest. But the same kind of careful, critical thinking and reading about it, that may be one of the ways to deal with it.
So let's explicate that as our kind of parting message for the listeners then. What was useful then for these councils to try to figure out that they differentiated between a forger and a non-forged text? So what was the basis of that? I mean, it may seem like in some ways it's a very obvious point, but I think it's really worthwhile for us to try to really hone in on it. What they did in the 17th century that actually was correct. They were able to distinguish between fake and real then by using
careful attention to language, by using careful attention to wording, by using careful attention to the question of who benefits from the story being told in this way, mm-hmm. who benefits from this narrative being constructed in this way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's the same kind of thing I think we could all be paying attention to today.
Yes. And we should also be aware of the fact that given these pressures, there will be fake things around.
Always.
When you have pressures.
Always.
Would you say there's more in some situations than others? Because you were talking about here that this being a period in which there was some kind of social change bringing about greater concerns about truth and falsity.
I'm not sure I'm in a place to say whether there's more. It certainly seems to be more current, more present, more certainly a issue that is up front and in the center of our minds right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and I meant in terms of also in the 17th century, that something happened then that was kind of a psychic shift mm-hmm. around a fake and real. So can we sort of conclude with what, would you speculate a little bit on what brought that shift and how that might give us some insight? It was about just a general social, there are times when we go through sort of a general social crisis over what should we think is real.
And that's definitely what is happening in the 17th century. It's a crisis of evidence, a crisis of certainties. What is certain?
Okay.
It's not clear at all in the 17th century.
So we've been through these before, that we go through a social crisis. What is, so we learned a lot. We learned a lot from the 17th century. in 1 hour. We learned that there are these periods of crises when there's just a lot of questions about what's truth. We learned that in this time, we might find the ironical situation of both a greater demand for evidence and a lot more trouble figuring out what is in fact real or not, and that we fall back. This is a historian speaking, making the plug for the being a historian. And I don't think I missed the point about majoring in history, that it's the historian and the tools that the historian uses to ask all those good questions. Then, so we have to recommit ourselves in 2019, just as they did in 1655, to saying, okay, we're going to read these documents. We're going to ask ourselves in this time, what is really good evidence?
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Yes. Well, that's a great note to end on. So I want to thank you, Professor Katie Harris, for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. And as always, you can listen to the show over again on OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com if you want to bone up a little bit more on what's the truth. And that's OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com. And next week, we will be back, we'll knock on another door. And stay tuned now for Radio Theater. And until then, go out and I guess say be critical. Is that what we're going to say? We're going to say go out and be critical.
Yes,
thank
please.
You.